KBOO is currently running a Kickstarter campaign to build a city of media makers. From February 8th to March 9th, you can become a media maker and help spread the word. Just go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to join.
Media makers, and thank you for your support of KBOO.
We're given an opportunity to share our stories, opinions, thoughts, and ideas in a meaningful manner with each other over airwaves. Not only does it increase our collective knowledge of what it means to be human, but our stories also have the potential to influence the public dialogue. This is the power of KBOO. You can help expand the conversation, invest in future media makers, and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Community radio is radio for the people, by the people. At KBOO, your neighbors, coworkers, and friends make radio so you can be sure that the issues they bring to you are the issues that matter. We believe strong communities invest in sharing knowledge with each other. Every month, KBOO offers free classes in the art of radio broadcasting so Portland can stay informed. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers, and thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO is a drop-off site for art supplies from now until March 5th. We're collecting them to support the walk entitled Water is Life, for those yet to come. The walk aims to address climate change, discuss renewable energy options, and also to share the learnings of Standing Rock with our youth. The walkers will stop by schools and community centers to engage the community in creating murals expressing identity and visions for the future. Art supplies needed for creating murals include Nova Color acrylic mural paint, rollers, trays, buckets, and more. Please bring your art supply donations to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Monday through Friday from 9 to 5, from now until March 5th. More information about the supplies needed and the walk can be found at kboo.fm/WaterIsLife2018.
This is Margaret Prescott. I'm out of the country and have put together a series of vintage historic Sojourner Truth interviews. So tune in to hear voices of artists, activists, authors, and more. Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a special discussion that took place in studio with Marshall Eddie Conway. He was a Black Panther Party leader in Baltimore, Maryland, and one of the country's longest held political prisoners. As a young man, he was convicted for killing a police officer, a crime he did not commit. He spent nearly 44 years in maximum security prisons. While inside, he earned 3 college degrees and organized multiple human rights groups. In 2014, he was finally released. He's now mobilizing with young people in Baltimore, where he's based, around the Freddie Gray case. And he is a journalist with the Real News Network, where he does a regular series entitled Rattling the Bars. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The deadline for another stopgap spending bill runs out tomorrow night. Lawmakers say they are on track to avoid a repeat of last month's government shutdown, though President Donald Trump unexpectedly raised that possibility if he doesn't get his way on immigration.
If we don't change the legislation, if we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill gang members, and we're just talking about MS-13. There are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown, and it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown if we don't get this stuff taken care of.
Trump's comments were disconnected from progress on Capitol Hill, where the House passed a short-term spending measure last night on a largely party-line vote of 245 to 182. Senate leaders were closing in on a larger long-term pact. The broader agreement would award large spending increases to both the Pentagon and domestic federal programs, as well as approve overdue disaster relief aid. Democratic leaders have dropped the strategy of using the funding fight to extract concessions on immigration, specifically on seeking extended protections for the young undocumented immigrants known as Dreamers brought to this country as children. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly threw fuel on the dispute as he defended Trump's proposed solution. The retired general noted the White House proposal would expand protection to include 1.8 million people, far more than the 690,000 who currently have DACA protections. He said Trump's proposal would include some people who were, quote, too lazy to sign up previously.
There are 690,000 official DACA registrants. And the president sent over what amounts to be 2.5 times that number to 1.8 million. The difference between 690 and 1.8 million were the people that some would say were too afraid to sign up, others would say were too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up.
Democrats challenged Kelly for his slur. Senate Democratic Leader Dick Durbin of Illinois, the party's chief immigration negotiator, added, quote, "It doesn't surprise me from General Kelly." Kelly is known as a hardliner on immigration. The White House says Donald Trump was just joking when he said Democrats may have been guilty of treason for not applauding during his State of the Union address. White House spokesman Hogan Gidley said the remark was tongue-in-cheek, but added that, quote, "What's serious is it seems as though the Democrats put their personal hatred for this president over their desires to see this country succeed." Arizona Republican Jeff Flake took to the Senate floor to say accusations of treason are not a joking matter.
"I have seen the president's most ardent defenders use the now weary argument that the president's comments were meant as a joke, just sarcasm, only tongue-in-cheek. But treason is not a punchline, Mr. President. We must recognize that this is aberrant, destructive behavior, whatever rationale its defenders may offer."
In a tweet, Illinois Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth, a double amputee veteran of the Iraq War, worked in a reminder that Trump had deferments during the Vietnam War for bone spurs. Duckworth wrote, quote, "We don't live in a dictatorship or a monarchy. I swore an oath in the military and in the Senate to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, not to mindlessly cater to the whims of cadet bone spurs and clap when he demands I clap," Duckworth tweeted. Donald Trump has asked the Pentagon to plan a grand parade of the armed forces in Washington this year to celebrate U.S. military strength. The Washington Post first reported Trump's January request. It quoted an unidentified military official as saying, "The marching orders were, I want a parade like the one in France." Trump was on hand for France's Bastille Day military parade when he visited Paris last July. New airstrikes launched by Russian and Syrian government forces on a besieged rebel-held region east of Damascus killed at least 8 people, according to opposition activists. The airstrikes on eastern Ghouta have killed dozens of civilians in the past few days. The punishing campaign by Russia and Syria also has battered the northwestern province of Idlib, the largest area under opposition control in Syria. The Idlib offensive hit hospitals and residential buildings. A hospital official in Idlib stood among the ruins of the facility. His remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera.
"The third airstrike was the most intense. It destroyed the entire hospital. I'm sorry to say that we've lost a huge medical institution serving the entire area. I have no alternative. Everyone is asking me where to go. I have no answer."
The children's organization Save the Children said in a statement, "The escalation in fighting in Idlib is placing thousands of children in extreme danger." I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. Eddie Conway, welcome. Thank you.
Baltimore-born and raised?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you got a lot of stories to tell us then.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Well, one thing I'm dying to find out about and get your view on was a bit about Baltimore during the civil rights years and then leading up to the Black Power years. You know what I mean?
Yes.
A lot was going on in Baltimore.
Yes. I was a preteen and teenager during that period. And to be quite frank, it was turbulent, but I didn't pay too much attention to it. You know,
too busy being a teenager?
Yeah, being a teenager, you know, enjoying life, going to school. But there was massive demonstrations to integrate shopping centers. Mm-hmm. There were parks in Baltimore.
So there was still segregation going on in Baltimore.
Yeah, in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. We couldn't go to certain parks. We couldn't swim in all the swimming pools.
And this is Maryland.
A black pool. Yes, and I think the mistake that people make sometimes is they think because Washington, D.C. and Baltimore is right there, it's the north when actually the Mason-Dixon line is between Pennsylvania and Maryland. Maryland is actually a southern state. And not only is it a southern state, but it has, over the years, created sundown kind of towns where black people couldn't even be in those towns after the sun go down, you know. Mm. And that existed all the way up until the late 60s. You know, there were areas that if you got caught in, you would be in trouble, right? So there was a lot of civil rights activity. But I think after 65, and of course I left the States in 64 and went to Europe and spent 3 years in Germany. But while I was in Germany...
Yeah, why? How did that happen?
Well, I joined the military.
Okay.
And so I was over there as a soldier. Mm-hmm. And it was from being over there that I looked back into America at last and saw through newspapers and other reports a tremendous amount of riots going on. And I decided not to go to Vietnam, which I had been scheduled for, and to come back home. And what I learned...
And that decision was yours to make?
It was mine to make because in order to go to Vietnam, I would have to actually re-enlist. I was a sergeant at the time.
Oh, okay.
And I would have had to take, like, several more years mm-hmm. and go get some more training. And then I would have been shipped off to Vietnam.
So you decided to leave when your time was up.
Yeah, my time was up. Mm-hmm. And actually, I kind of left a little before my time was up because there was this horrible incident that I woke up to one morning. In the newspapers, I was reading the newspapers religiously, and in the front of the Stars and Stripes, which is the military newspaper, there's this huge picture on the front of 25 or 30 black women in Newark, New Jersey, with their fists up, angry. You could see from the picture that they were protesting. And in the middle of the crosswalk of that street was an armored personnel carrier, one of those
military
vehicles. Tanks, uh-huh. You know, and on top of that tank was a 50 caliber machine gun, and it was pointed at the women that were protesting. And so as I get up, I'm looking at this guy, and it's not significant that he was blonde hair, blue eyed, you know, that wasn't an important factor there. What was important was he had his fingers like 1 inch from the triggers, like that 50 caliber machine gun, it's like driven. And once you touch those triggers, it'll kind of like electrocute you for 25 or 30 rounds. You can't get off of it because it's like it just grabs you and it just fires automatically. And those bullets were
like pointed at these women.
At the women, and the bullets were like maybe six inches long, you know. So, I mean, and it's the kind of round, the 50 caliber round that will go through concrete, cinder blocks, through one side of a house, through the house, through the other side of the house, into three or four more houses. So I knew, I mean, right then and there, I said, well, if this guy sneezes, he's going to accidentally kill all those black women on the corner. And why is this happening in the black community? And I was getting ready to go to Vietnam, so... I read the story, and it seemed that the night before, a band of black guys had raided the National Guard Armory and had stole X amount of weapons, and the governor declared a state of emergency. They called out the feds, the city police, the state police, and the army. And they rounded up, and this is in 67 now.
It was a war going on.
Every black man in Newark and locked them up. And I was still having problems understanding. And then they went house to house to house, and they tore out walls. They tore up floorboards. They just vandalized the houses looking for these weapons. And so the women were out there protesting that their doors had been kicked in.
Yeah.
You know, the house was left in repair. Who's going to pay for this? Where's my man? Where's my son? Where's my dad? You know.
Yeah.
And I looked at that, and I looked at my uniform. I was a sergeant at the time, and I'm saying, like, wait a minute. I'm getting ready to go to Vietnam, possibly maybe have to kill somebody in defense of the United States for democracy, et cetera. And here in the middle of the black community, there's a tank and machine guns pointed at black women. And the first thing that crossed my mind was, well, my mother could be in that crowd. So what am I doing? And that's what made me decide that, well, okay, I need to go home, see what the problem is, and address it. And I went the long way around to get here. But when I got home, the civil rights law had already been passed in 65.
65, yes. Civil Rights Act.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so I'm making an assumption that, okay, we won, it's all good, everything's okay. But instead, what I found was massive unemployment and then menial employment. Blacks were not allowed to get into white collar jobs. So even though all of those doors had been open, we couldn't afford to go in.
Right.
We couldn't afford to go in the restaurant.
Yeah.
We couldn't afford to send our children to school. We couldn't afford to move into the areas that they said we could move in because we did not have that money. So initially...
Yeah, Martin Luther King, by the way, has a great quote on that where he's saying, what's the point of integration, you know, if we can't afford to go in those restaurants and buy the food, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And remind our audience that our in-studio guest is Eddie Conway, who spent nearly 44 years in prison for a crime he did not permit. He was a leading member of the Black Panther Party in Baltimore, Maryland, and we're getting a little idea of what got Eddie into the movement for human, civil, and economic rights. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. So you figured, well, the Civil Rights Act has been passed. This stuff is supposed to be resolved, except it hasn't.
Right.
Yeah.
That's correct. And conditions were bad, and they had not changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were laws on the books, but the conditions in the communities, in the ghettos, et cetera, was really the same. The treatment was really the same in terms of how the community was being policed and occupied. And discrimination was still there, you know. But the new factor was like, well, we're not blocking you out, but can you really afford to do this? You know. So I looked around, worked with the NAACP, and in fact, we integrated.
You went back to Baltimore.
I was
then.
Back in Baltimore.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the NAACP and CORE at the time.
Congress of Racial Equality.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Was engaged in a campaign to get us white-collar jobs. And so I got involved in that, and I ended up becoming a firefighter.
And uh-huh.
So because they weren't letting us join the police department, fire department, I mean, any kind of management kind of thing, you couldn't get with professional.
Right.
So I became a fireman. And while in the fire department, it was six of us integrated the fire department. They had 101 people, 95 of the guys were white, and six of us were black, and they kept us on the midnight shift, of course, so you didn't know we were actually firemen.
Uh-huh.
You know, but in the process, and this was like on the suburbs of outside of Baltimore, in the process, I came in contact with a lot of racial polarization, hostility toward blacks in the city, and people buying and selling arms and actually talking about, well, if they ride in this city, we got something for them, you know. And sometimes I would walk into the station house in total silence. Whole conversations would stop.
Would stop, yeah.
Yes, you know.
You wonder, what were they talking about before I walked in?
Yeah, you know, and I kind of knew, you know, and they knew not to talk about this stuff around me also because I wasn't actually militant at that point. I was certainly a black man that wasn't going to put up with any kind of, you know, racism. From that point, I realized that I needed to kind of like join something else a lot more with substance, something that was looking out for the black community. I looked around at
a bit more than where the NAACP was at the time.
Yes. And I looked around and I seen a lot of organizations, but the Black Panther Party caught my eye. They were feeding children across the country. They were talking about making systemic changes in the community. They were talking about organizing the community's resources.
Health clinics.
Yeah, health clinics, et cetera. And they were talking about protecting the black community also. So I actually joined. And it had to be thousands of black organizations, some small, some as small as 5 or 10 people, some as large as hundreds and hundreds of people that was in throughout the United States.
Yeah, and Eddie, I'm glad you mentioned that because sometimes in telling this story, it's hard for people, particularly younger people, to imagine just the level of mobilization and activism that was going on at the time and what it took in those struggles to desegregate and get the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and all. I mean, people were, you know, seriously in this thing, right? So I'm glad that you were able to paint that kind of picture. So you had organizations like NAACP, you had Congress of Racial Equality. And at the time, I think my aunt in Brooklyn was actually a member of Brooklyn Core. You had the Urban League, and the churches were also a place of mobilization back then.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
they've
correct.
Lost some of that.
Yeah.
So for people who weren't in any organization, you know, there was always, you know, something you can do and some place that you could fit. But tell us a little bit what I wanted to ask you about. I think it's a serious question for movements everywhere. You are a leading person in the Black Panther Party. You have the Black Panther Party doing the free breakfast program. J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, said the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program was the greatest threat to U.S. security, which is interesting that that was singled out. So you have then this whole COINTELPRO operation happening. And I remember talking to some of the elders in the movement. I remember talking to Selma James, whose husband C.L.R. James is a key figure activist that got thrown out during the McCarthy period. But Selma sort of jokingly tells stories about they would have meetings in Los Angeles, you know, militant radical stuff. And maybe there'll be 12 people in the meeting. They found out later that 8 of them were agents.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing. So in COINTELPRO, you likely had a lot of that going on.
Oh, you had a tremendous amount of infiltration. I doubt seriously if it was to the level that they infer, but what happens is that, just in Maryland, say, for instance, in our chapters, and I think we had offices in maybe 3 different locations, there was 5 agents, either from the police department or the FBI or national security. In fact, one of the key people in the Black Panther Party there was a top national security agency.
Oh, my goodness. So, a key person.
A key person, right? And so there was a lot of infiltration. But this whole COINTELPRO thing, which is the counterintelligence program from the FBI, had a mandate to use any resources of any law enforcement or any government agency that exists, the IRS, et cetera. And they used everybody's informers, so it was impossible to tell how many people were actually infiltrated into the Black Panther Party, or agent provocateurs was one of their key kind of people they would have. I'll just give you an example. We had an incident a block away from our office in East Baltimore, and the police were arresting somebody. A panther jumped in it, got involved in it, got in a scuffle, got away, ran down the street, ran into the Black Panther Party headquarters, ran to our headquarters, ran out the back, and kept going. And, of course, they surrounded our office and demanded that we give that person up. That person wasn't in there. So a number of our members got locked up as a result of not letting them come in the office. And eventually the force was so overwhelming that they let them in. And then at the trial, we discover that this guy, the guy that ran through the thing, had been working for the police department all the time.
All along.
And the incident was fabricated, and the local newspaper discovered it in through investigation, and that's the only thing that exonerated us. But meanwhile, we had spent all that money on bails, money on lawyers, you know, people had sat in jails. Yeah. So yeah. That's the kind of stuff they were doing. That was the nice stuff.
That was the nice stuff.
The bad stuff was...
Right. Hold that thought. And before you talk about the bad stuff, too, you know, I always am reminded of what happened in Chicago with Chairman Fred Hampton and about, you know, a key person who was also an informant that really set that whole thing up.
Yes.
And Fred was just such an incredible young leader, bringing together Black people, brown people. He was even able to apparently organize some little hillbillies, even some little racist hillbillies to come and, you know, be part of the cause, right? In some way. So somebody like that who has that skill to bring people together, considered a danger. But I don't suppose, you know, given the experience you all went through, and talking to folks now, if there are any pointers of anything that you could look out for. Because a lot of times, you know what I mean? You're working with folks. You don't know who's who. You're trying to figure things out. You got to keep your eyes at the back of your head, so to speak.
Yeah, I think in our case, and this was like lessons learned the hard way through direct experience, loss of lives, loss of freedoms, et cetera. But I think today, looking back, hindsight, looking at the COINTELPRO files, all that kind of stuff, I think you could probably have one rule. And that rule is that if somebody in your organization is advocating illegal activity, advocating the use of violence or force, or is acting erratic when during times of confrontation, then you need to either remove that person from your organization or remove yourself from that person, and under no circumstances engage and get involved in any of those kind of things. So if you keep what you're doing legal, there's a good possibility you will survive any agent provocateurs or informers. But let me, if I could make a point.
Yeah.
Because Tupac Shakur, his mother, right, was one of the New York 21. This is a major...
A lot of people forget that about Tupac's mom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a major case that happened in New York, and 21 leaders of the different New York chapters got locked up, and they got locked up as a result of a guy named Gene Roberts. Gene Roberts was Malcolm X's bodyguard. When Malcolm X got shot, this guy, Gene Roberts, is the guy that's bending over Malcolm X, giving them mouth-to-mouth respiration on the stage.
I wonder who he was working for then.
Yes, well, that's the point now. He was the chief of security for Malcolm X, and because of those credentials, he joined the Black Panther Party after Malcolm X's death. And he was part of the leadership meeting, and he would meet with the leaders, and he would suggest, let's do this, let's do that. Really militant, really radical, really kind of aggressive, and they just kept refusing to engage and involved in that kind of stuff. And one day, they locked all of them up. And they said, oh, Pampers gonna bomb Botanical Garden, Pampers are gonna bomb Union Station.
Yeah.
Macy's is going to be attacked. So on and so on and so on. So they gave each one of them $100,000 bails. And so we had to raise that money, which amounted to, I believe, $2 million and something. And then we got everybody out, and then some other incident happened, and they put them all back in. And they stayed in jail for 2 years. The leadership, the entire leadership of New York, in jail for 2 years. And then when they had the trial, Gene Roberts is on the stand, and he's a New York City police officer. And he had been an officer the whole time he was undercover with Malcolm X. And he worked for the New York City Police Department officially, got these people locked up. They had never did anything at all, but he just kept bringing things in and saying, look at this, look at that, look at this. And when the jury heard, the jury found him not guilty of 156 charges and turned him loose after about 4 or 5 hours, but they lingered in jail for 2 years, cost $2 million, and caused that split between Huey and Eldridge Cleaver that ended up splitting the Black Panther Party. And then this is a case where nobody agreed to do anything wrong, and they still destroyed that.
They still managed to get through. Our guest is Eddie Conway, who spent almost 44 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, accused of murder of a police officer. He was a key figure in the Black Panther Party in Baltimore, Maryland. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And when we return, we're going to continue just this incredible story, a treasure trove of vital information in our discussion with Eddie Conway. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. This is Margaret Prescott. Check us out at SoundCloud.com. And you could also check out all of our back shows as well as today's shows on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you are a member of Facebook, please like and friend us on Facebook. We cover a lot of information we don't necessarily get to or only get to in a limited way while we are on the air. This is Margaret Prescott, and delighted and really honored to have in studio Marshal Eddie Conway, leading member of the Baltimore chapter of the Black Panther Party, who in 1971 was convicted of a crime he did not commit. He was convicted of murder of a police officer, and almost 44 years later, he was released. And we're just hearing an incredible story about the FBI's infiltration of the Black Panther Party. And Eddie, you know, I believe, especially given what J. Edgar Hoover said, that infiltration, not only the FBI, but intelligence agencies, law enforcement agencies, wasn't necessarily because the Panthers were running around openly carrying guns, but really because of the connection with the community work, the breakfast programs, the health clinics, the 10-point program, in addition to saying, well, we have the right to self-defense. But I was just so moved. For listeners who are just joining us, Eddie just told us the story of Gene Roberts, who was a chief of security for Malcolm X, the bodyguard, the man who was over Malcolm when he was shot. Turned out he then and later with the Black Panther Party in New York City was a member of New York City Police Department. I mean, it's so emotional to hear that, because Malcolm's loss, Malcolm meant so much to us, and we lost a lot when we lost Malcolm. And who knows if we're fully going to know this story. But I really appreciate you reminding our audience, or for those learning the first time, about the role that a New York City police agent played.
Officer.
Officer. An officer.
Yes.
An officer himself. And yeah. and Tupac Shakur's mom, whom long time ago I met, I actually did an interview with her on Mothers, of all things. You know, Tupac mm-hmm. has this song about moms, right? Mm-hmm. Talk about low-income moms and welfare yeah. moms and whatnot. And she was right on the money then. Okay, so fast forwarding a bit, the COINTELPRO operation happened. You wound up on the inside, right?
Yes.
Tell us just a little bit. I want to talk about some of the organizing going on inside prison and what kind of information you all were getting from the outside. But tell me a little about the impact that then had on your family.
Okay. And if I could just step back for one minute.
Of course.
Because I think it's important because like what I do now is I'm an executive producer for The Real News.
And we're going to get to that.
Yeah. yeah. And the reason why I mention it is because what COINTELPRO did to the Black Panther Party was to use the media, the national media.
Mainstream media, call it in Pacifica.
To create a narrative that made us look like we were black, angry, militant radicals that didn't like white people, that didn't want to do anything except cause confrontations. They painted that picture in spite of the fact that we were a not multinational, but we were an internationalist revolutionary organization that worked with all kinds of forces. You mentioned the Patriot Party, white people up in Chicago. We work with the Puerto Ricans. We work with Latinos. We work with blacks. We work with Native Americans. We worked across the board with all
That's why
people.
Y'all was so dangerous.
Yeah, that's what was dangerous. It was the fact that we were talking about socialism and the fact that we managed to form alliances across the racial spectrum, and the government and the ruling class didn't want that. Now, what happened to me is as I landed in the prison, I had already arrived there seeing myself as a fully developed human being, and I walked through the door, and they're treating the prisoners like animals. And so right the first day, conflict, and I stayed in conflict for combat. For at least 6 of the first 7 years, and I stayed on lockup in solitary confinement and whatnot. I might have been out for 2 months here, 3 months there, 4 months over here, and so on. But in the period of 7 years, I spent 6 of those years in solitary confinement.
Your humanity.
Defending my humanity because I refused to let them dehumanize me. The process was just took a toll on all of us. We were in a fight. This was the years of George Jackson out here in California. It was the years of Attica on the East Coast. And prisoners were standing up for their rights at last because of the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement. Prisoners were really taking a position that we are no longer going to be treated like animals. And the cost of being on lockup, in combat, getting injured, et cetera, really took a toll on my family as well as other people's families. It caused me, and I think probably now, hindsight, I realize I sacrificed my family for the greater good of our community. And it was probably a mistake in the sense that I should have split that time. I should have been more conscious. I mean,
tried to balance it.
Fortunately, my sons grew up normal and healthy as a result of their mother, you know, and family and learning and so on. But that's one of the things that people that are engaging in struggle need to understand is they have to find that balance. They have to balance what they know to be their mandate, their mission to do right with also building and keeping good bonds with their family. You know, you need to have both of those things to kind of like survive any kind of ordeal intact.
We all struggle with that, don't we?
Yeah.
I know I certainly
yeah.
have.
You know.
Yeah.
So it did take a toll on my family. And of course, it took a toll on me. But at the same time, I mean, we made tremendous gains. But over the years, all those gains have pretty much been eroded because the generational ties, you know, the elders talking to the young people in the community and young people raising younger people, those ties were broken with the war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on poverty, with all wars on the black and poor communities.
That's it.
And it separated the parents and the grandparents from the children and left the children out to fend for themselves without the transfer of that knowledge and information from generation to generation. And they had to fend for themselves. They had to find out what to do. But and the conditions also changed as they took away the men and women and the role models.
Yeah.
Conditions, they also took away the jobs.
Well, let me ask you this, though, in terms of the organizing going on inside the prison itself, mm-hmm. because we know that there are a number of people who are jailhouse lawyers who, you know, fight, and some successfully, their cases on the inside, who stand up and protect each other. Right now, I've been somewhat knowing and a bit supporting a case of the Dallas Six, of these six black men in prison in Pennsylvania who were whistleblowers against the torture that they witnessed inside the prison. And some of it was multiracial. They protested, you know, part of it was a guy who was Puerto Rican that they had put in what they call a torture chair, restraining mm-hmm. chair. Mm-hmm. Another was a white prisoner who they tortured so bad that he committed suicide. And these black men, mm-hmm. right, talk about the cross-racial concerns, tried to get information out. When they weren't getting a response from the prison, they did a peaceful protest where they covered their cells with sheets.
Mm-hmm.
The guards came in there, beat the hell out of them, and then charged them with rioting, right? Now, mm-hmm. these guys, the case just started after 6 years, just started shortly before this interview happened, and so we'll see what happens in that case. But we do know that there's a lot of organizing and collaboration that happens inside the prisons, but we've also heard of people like Mamiya talk about, you know, a little bit of a generational divide, too. Mm-hmm. And that's when you said what you just did, it made me think about that. If you could talk a little bit about the possibility of the kind of organizing that was going on inside the prisons, right? And then some of the challenges you face with that generational divide.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens in the prison system is a direct result from what's happening out in the community.
Yeah.
If people are agitating, mobilizing, educating, and organizing out in the community to change their conditions, then when some of those people get locked up, or then their friends get locked up and whatnot, they take that fight inside the prison.
Yeah.
And they organize. And then people inside the prison can also see that there are people outside organizing, agitating, for change, and
yeah.
they make an alliance with people outside. But the conditions inside the prison is mainly reflected of the conditions outside the prison. And so today now, as people are getting locked up there, now the Black Lives Matter, the movements, the environmental movements, the Occupy movements, the immigration movements, the XL pipeline, et cetera, whatever. As people get locked up now, they are going inside the prisons and they are having an influence and impact on what's going on. And people outside are supporting that kind of effort. There is a generational thing. And I had to figure out how to overcome it because young people extremely angry with being abandoned. You know, y'all didn't teach us anything. Y'all wasn't there for us. Y'all didn't look out for us. Y'all didn't do what y'all was supposed to do. Political prisoners, revolutionaries, radicals, et cetera, are the exception. Young people say, y'all tried. Y'all did this or y'all did that. But the generation in general succumbed to drugs and dope and Superfly and all that, and they went away and they left us, and we're angry, and they're angry.
Yeah, and some of that drug stuff was actually organized.
Oh, yeah.
You know, here in L.A., mm-hmm. you know, the whole crack cocaine epidemic and Freeway Ricky Ross
being
the tool, but that money from bringing in crack cocaine on military planes used to fund Reagan's illegal war. So that's a whole
in
other.
In Nicaragua.
So we know where that came from. And just recently it's come up again. I don't know if you heard about it. There was Bill Clinton was in Pennsylvania recently in Philadelphia and got confronted by some Black Lives Matter protesters.
Yeah, yesterday or the day before.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Around the day before this interview, you and I were doing this interview. And he reverted back to 13-year-olds hyped up on crack. And then Hillary Clinton, I played a clip of her calling young people, you know, they mean really black and brown people, super predators. So this is the kind of environment of these young people that you're talking about that came up being treated as though they were super predators. Right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And, you know, no one asked, but they should have asked, why is that 13-year-old out there? Because you locked his father up. You locked his grandfather up. You cut welfare out. You did all of those things. You made the disparity between powder cocaine, which white people normally would use, and crack cocaine, which was the cheaper form of cocaine used in the community, 100 to 1. So I got an ounce. I get 30, 40, 50 years. You got 4 ounces, and you get 18 months.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, that's what created, what fueled this whole prison industrial complex. But it also left those young people alone. So what, and I just recently got out of prison for 2 years ago, and what we did in there was we used the older people that we educated, that we organized, and we used them to start mentoring young people and building that bond and teaching them about their relationship to their community, their relationship to their history. And then giving them the tools that they could to negotiate successfully through the prison and go back into the community and help.
Yeah. You know? That's
so that kind of work is going on in the prisons.
Right. And our guest in studio is Eddie Conway, who spent almost 44 years, can't imagine that, inside for a crime he did not permit, as he just said, just out 2 years ago. He's based in Baltimore, Maryland. And before going to prison, he was a leading member of the Black Panther Party there. He spent some time in the military and came back and got involved in the movement for human rights and justice in the United States. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It's always amazing how the time flies. Eddie, I feel like we need like a kind of a mini university with you in a way to talk about all the things we need to talk about, because I'm just looking at the clock. We've got like about 10 minutes left. And before we talk about, because I know you have been, you're out, you're in Baltimore, you've been a journalist with the Real News Network. I want to talk a bit about that. You've been very involved in the organizing around the Freddie Gray case there. But before that, I get back to the organizing in prisons. You mentioned Attica, you mentioned George Jackson. I made some reference to a prisoner like Mumia Abu-Jamal, a journalist who is still in inside prison. Now, there have been a series of hunger strikes by prisoners in Georgia and other places, but the one likely best known is the California prisoner hunger strike that started 30,000 strong.
Yes.
And I always tell people, you know, it's the largest hunger strike that we know of in U.S. history or anywhere, and that happened behind prison bars. And also, what the prisoners have said is that part of how they were able to organize that as effectively as they did is they worked to establish an agreement to end racial hostilities between the black prisoners, the white prisoners, the Native American prisoners, the Latino prisoners. And on that basis of the agreement to end racial hostilities, they were able to do that organizing. And they've done so much to bring out the torture of solitary confinement, where even now you got President Obama talking about it. But one of the things they have said is that they are now suffering retaliation from the prison guards, I'm sure because of the hunger strike, but specifically because of the agreement to end racial hostilities. Isn't that interesting? Again, that's the thing that the prison folks find most dangerous, getting back to George Jackson, the cross-racial stuff he was doing?
Yeah, because you cannot control the prison without dividing and conquering the prison population. You know, 100 guards cannot control 2,000 or 3,000 people that might be housed in that prison without having them fighting and conflicting with each other. And so it's a almost a necessity, divide and conquer. And so anybody that's organizing around peaceful coexistence and group activities becomes the threat, you know. And it's in some cases, in California has been known for it, they'll get assassinated. They'll get attacked. They'll get beat down by some strange person that's going to end up making parole as a result of that attack. So, yes, that's the most debilitating thing that you can do to a prison is to unify and organize across all those lines. That's really a threat. That's the greatest threat, right? And the same thing is on the East Coast. What we did, I in fact was a key player in organizing the United Prisoners Labor Union, demanding minimum wage, you know. And they just went crazy. They went berserk about that. We organized. We organized 500 members of a labor union, and got the same labor union that Martin Luther King got killed helping, 1199E, to accept us as a chapter. And they just went berserk about that. We weren't doing anything at all except demanding that we get paid fair wages for our work.
Wow.
Yeah.
And just finally, we're going to have to get back in touch with you, even if we talk by phone, so I can ask you some of the other things I want to ask you about.
That's not a problem.
Because, you know, it's important for our listeners to know this. But you have been a journalist with the Real News Network, do incredible work, the Real News Network. And I visited the building the Real News Network works out of in Baltimore. Tell us about your role then as an alternative journalist, that interrelationship then with the work that you are so involved in terms of justice in the Freddie Gray case, Freddie Gray being the young man, you know, the rough ride killed by police in Baltimore.
Yes. I work as an executive producer for the Real News, and what we do is we try to report the news that's not being reported by the mass media, corporate media. 86% of the media is owned by 6 corporations, believe it or not. We report the news from down on the ground, from the workers' perspective, from people that are with no voice, the marginalized people. We go down in the community and we talk to people and find out what their issues are, and we report them. We find stories that shows what positive organizing look like in the community, and we present that. When you look at, in say, Baltimore, our particular region, most of the stories about minorities, poor people, people of color, are stories about violence.
Mm-hmm.
They're stories, you know, if it bleed, it lead. And it's not about what we're doing and how we're doing it and how we're trying to stand the communities back up and how we're trying to overcome some of those draconian measures that they're using in the community, where they just raid the community. People can live in a particular house and they're sitting on their steps and they get locked up for loitering. Sitting on the steps. I mean, this kind of activity don't take place in white communities or upper middle class communities, only down in the communities where we are. Mm-hmm. And so we report all that, and we look for not just the report, but we look also for what solutions would look like. So we have town hall meetings. We actually go and work with people in the community and have meetings down in the community and televise them.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Tell us where things are now. Well, I'm kind of torn between that and asking. Let me ask you this, because I could, I'll find out more about the Freddie Gray case. You might want to say a bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
But you have also been doing some international travel, have you?
Yes.
Recently?
Yeah.
Just tell us a little about that. I mean, you mentioned earlier that as a Panther, you all were internationalists and built, you know, those kinds of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So just thoughts from you now, in terms of that, the kind of international connection, the importance of it, and perhaps were some of the reasons that you were traveling, mm-hmm. you've been traveling?
Yes, well, we had a relationship in Venezuela with Telesur. As journalists, we work together. We transfer stories. We look at the conditions in South America. We've been into Africa. We look at the conditions in the Pan-African diaspora.
Okay.
And we meet and talk and interact, and we report stories as well as stories across the country. Because what we find is that our plight in Baltimore is similar to the plight in Johannesburg, or similar to the plight in Caracas, or similar to the plight in Lusaka or wherever, or in Athens. So we try to bring all of those stories and put them on our site so people can see that there's a common thread throughout all of this. It's a small group of people that's controlling the wealth of the planet, and the rest of us are suffering. And
yeah.
So we try to tell that story, and we interact with those people because they all have a common interest.
Yeah, and just finally then on the Freddie Gray case, because mm-hmm. in addition to your journalism,
yes.
you've also been doing community work,
yes.
organizing around
yes.
this.
And we've been working in that community 2 years before Freddie Gray got beaten. We've been working 50 feet away from where Freddie Gray was actually beaten at, organizing in that community. We're still there. I think a second trial is getting ready to start next month, I believe it is, mm-hmm. For the second police. The first one was hung jury. He's being forced to testify now against his cohort.
So that would be starting in May of 2016.
Yes, mm-hmm. And it'll probably be delayed or postponed or something, because I'm sure they don't want it ending at the end of the summer in a bad way, you know, because there's still tensions in the community, and nobody believes that there's going to be justice. And one of the bad things is the way in which the officers were indicted. The three white officers that beat Freddie Gray in the community, that caused his neck to be injured and so on before they put him in the paddy wagon, are charged with minor charges. The three black officers who transported Freddie Gray are charged with the major charges. They're going to end up being the ones probably that's going to be the scapegoat for this when the beating actually occurred down on the street by three other officers. So, I mean,
it's already a racial divide.
Yeah, it's already bad, you know.
Yeah.
So, and black people are looking at it and saying, yeah, they're going to give it to the brothers and the sisters are going to get the charge. And they might have gave him a rough ride. And the medical examiner said he bounced around in there. But if his neck wasn't broken, if he wasn't injured to the degree that he was, he would have survived a rough ride. I mean, they've been doing rough rides in the police department all across the country in black communities for centuries, you know. So, but it was his injury that was caused by that beating that led to his death,
and
right?
You could
but they're
see
gonna
that
walk
injury
away.
When they were
yeah.
taking him into the,
yeah,
into the
certainly.
Vehicle.
Yeah.
Right.
And so far they haven't even called most of the witnesses in the community that saw it and said they witnessed it, and they haven't been called, talked to, or investigated, you know. So I mean, it's already a very shaky proposition going into the summer. And I don't know exactly where it's going to lead, but there's a simmering in the community down on the ground. You know, the churches and the official NAAC and different agencies is trying to kind of like pacify everything. But down under the bottom of that, it's an anger simmering.
Wow. On that note, I'm afraid we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. So we're going to have to return to this conversation. Mr. Eddie Conway, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I'd like to thank our Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, our engineer. I'd like to thank Mark Maxwell for his help with today's show. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-734-7000.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Up next, we have Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 11:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Between the Covers with Ken Jones, talks with Paul Cohen, author of the novel Glam Shack. And at 11:30, The Film Show, filmmakers from Cascadia, Film Festival of African American Films, in Portland International Film Festival, join SW Concert in the studio. And remember, KBOO just started our Kickstarter campaign today. Help us build a city of media makers by going to Kickstarter and search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
For decades, KBOO News and Public Affairs has welcomed radical and spirited activists in the Northwest and beyond. KBOO is central to connecting the world to what is happening in Portland and the Northwest. We put the mic in everyone's hands. Help amplify the stories of people in your own backyard, invest in future media makers, and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers, and thank you for your support of KBOO.
Help us help you keep Portland weird. Join Contessa de la Luna of the World Famous Confessional for the 6th annual Contessa de la Luna Valentine Spectacular and Fashion Show. We're giving away a $100 cash prize plus live performances by Contessa de la Luna. Get your weird on and bring a date. Advance tickets available at Brown Paper Tickets. All proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's Thursday, February 15th, 7 to 9:45 p.m., feel the love of your other Contessa de la Lunatics. Contessa de la Luna's Valentine's Spectacular, Thursday, February 15th at the Clinton Street.